This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. We have three bills on the agenda. We're going to start with Senator Sparks. Senate File 448. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 448 to you this afternoon. Senate File 448 is the result of the Next-Gen Board Biofuels Task Force work that took place over the interim. Minnesota has been a leader and needs to make room for the next generation of biofuels to continue to be a leader. Senate File 448 gives new fuels like biobutanol access to the marketplace and increases the goals of the petroleum displacement. I believe, Mr. Chairman and members, that this bill will greatly benefit all Minnesotans from the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and also our reliance on fossil fuels. I believe in your packets you have a list that's represented by the Biofuels Task Force. The Commissioner of Agriculture did a good job working closely with all those interested parties, and the bill before you is a result of that hard work. Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's your pleasure. We can certainly have, or I would ask maybe Mr. Knopf, if you'd like to run through the bill, maybe kind of quick, give a summary, and then we do have some people that like to testify in favor of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the first section of the bill updates the cellulosic biofuel production goal to basically put in the term biofuel instead of just ethanol. But also, we do have an expiration for it in 2015. Again, I think Senator Sparks mentioned the petroleum, basically the petroleum replacement goal is going to be used in the future for some things that we'll see later on here in the bill. Section 3, this is the definition of green economy. And what it does is it replaces, we're now using the petroleum replacement goal instead of the goal that I just mentioned on sections 1 and 2, and then also the 25 by 25 goal. And we'll see, again, there'll be some amendments to that later. Section 4 is advanced biofuel, and that has the meaning given it. Now, you should have a summary in your packet. It's a federal law, and I printed that out in the summary as to what an advanced biofuel is defined as. Section 5 is just defining biofuel, and it includes ones that have a pathway and are approved by the U.S. EPA, and it includes both advanced and conventional. Section 6 is a conventional biofuel definition, which basically means ethanol derived from cornstarch. There's also a reference to the public law, but that's basically what that says, too. Section 7, now we're making some changes in the minimum content requirement for ethanol. We're now expanding it to all biofuels. We also removed, there was a trigger. If you look on 3.8, there's a whichever is greater. There was a trigger that said that if the feds went beyond the 10% ethanol, we would automatically go to whatever the feds allowed. And that trigger is taken out, but it's being replaced that we're opening this up to all biofuels. So it's 10% of the biofuel or the maximum percent biofuel by volume authorized, but it's going to be at the option of the person responsible for the product. And then you'll see at the latter part of that section, you will see there's a schedule there for we're basically starting in 2013, 90% of the biofuel used to blend with gasoline should be 90% conventional biofuel, and you'll see that it ramps down till after 2025, no minimum, then, and any biofuel could be blended with gasoline, and not just ethanol, or a percentage of another biofuel. Section 8, we're updating the Clean Air Act waiver language to reflect we're repealing the E20 mandate, which hasn't happened. It only has another year or so to be effective, and it's not likely to happen. So that's being repealed in this bill. And then we're also cleaning up the statute a little bit. And then on page 4 of that section, in paragraph B, we're also expanding it to include biofuels and not just ethanol. Again, to be consistent with the remainder of it. And then the limited liability waiver, again, we're eliminating the reference to the E20 mandate. That's on 4.18. You see that striking of or subdivision 1A. And then section 10, this is we're modifying the petroleum replacement promotion. or the goal for the promotion, and you'll see that current law says 20% by 2015, which is not likely to be met. So on the next page, you'll see that it's being ramped up. It's 2015, it'll be 14%, and then the ultimate goal in 2025 is 30%. The subdivision 2 also has the commissioners involved in this promotion, convening a task force under their own authority in Chapter 15 for the next, until December 31, 2015. You can see in the bottom of the page that the task force can't last beyond December 31st, 2015. This one will also, or this section also expands one of the duties or one of the activities, if you look on 5.33, that Clause 6, facilitating the production and use of advanced biofuels in the state. And then, Mr. Chair, on page 6, we have the addition of, for purposes of the petroleum tax law, just a definition of biobutanol. And I think this was requested by the Department of Commerce, if my understanding, to make it very clear when biobutanol is used, what the standards for the biobutanol. And then Section 12, as I said earlier, that's the repeal of the E20 mandate. And you can see that it's on page 1R in the appendix. You've got the language of the subdivision that's being repealed. That, Mr. Chairman, is the end of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Knopf. Senator Sparks, you had several witnesses.
Mr. Chair, and I just would like to thank Mr. Knopf. I know the staff has worked very hard trying to find common ground with all the stakeholders. I know he's worked hard in the last few days, and I think he did a nice job explaining the bill. With me today, I think we're going to kick it off. I have Mr. Glenn Johnston, the Executive Vice President from GEVO, and I'd like to turn it over to him if that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself before you begin.
Glenn Johnston, Executive Vice President from GEVO. I want to thank the Chair and the committee for allowing me to speak today. What I'm going to be talking a little bit about is give you an overview of who GEVO is and give you a brief information on isobutanol or biobutanol. So GEVO is a publicly traded company. We are a small company that has our first plant in Luverne, and I'll talk about that in just a second. But we are commercializing isobutanol. Isobutanol is a platform molecule. It is a 4-carbon alcohol which can be used in a lot of different areas of the petroleum industry and is used in its petroleum-derived version today. There are many different markets that it can be used in, and it does have a lot of value across the supply chain. So what we do today is we take any kind of sugar, whether it's cellulosic or starch-derived. We go through a yeast. This is inside of a fermenter, just like you would beer and wine production. But instead of making ethanol, we make isobutanol. Isobutanol is removed through our separation technology, and we produce a very pure grade of isobutanol down in our plant in Luverne. In the, I know this is really small from up there, but the picture of Luverne, Minnesota, is the ethanol plant, which was a dry corn ethanol plant. We have converted it over to an isobutanol plant and have produced isobutanol in there. Due to this legislation that currently exists in the state of Minnesota, I have to ship every drop I make in that out of state. I cannot use any of it in the state of Minnesota because of the way the bill is currently listed as ethanol only. I make isobutanol. It's not ethanol. So I have to ship all of the material out of the state for consumption right now. So what is isobutanol? Isobutanol is a platform molecule like I spoke of. It can be used just like isobutanol is used in a petroleum refinery today. Isobutanol can be dehydrated to what's called isobutylene. Isobutylene is a building block that is used to produce a lot of the different materials you use today. Whether that's plastics, whether that's gasoline, whether that's diesel, all of these materials are used when they're refined from crude oil. And we can replace over 40% of the petrochemicals and over the 100% of the hydrocarbon fuels with isobutanol. That's the possibility of this molecule. What we've done with this molecule is we've taken it to Texas and set up a pilot facility down there. We've converted it to isobutylene and then converted it to jet fuel. We currently are selling the U.S. Air Force right now jet fuel out of our production plant in Luverne, and they are flying jets on it. This is a picture of a jet that was flown last summer. It's a Warthog, an A-10 Warthog, out of Elgin Air Force Base in Florida that was flown on isobutanol converted to jet fuel. And so this is reality. This is happening now. And this legislation is critically important to maintain Minnesota's leadership role in biofuels. If you do not move this forward, isobutanol will not be able to be used in the state of Minnesota, and Minnesota will start to fall behind other states as they use this material. That's the end of it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Right, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Adam Schubert. I'm representing Butamax Advanced Biofuels. Butamax is a joint venture of BP and DuPont, which has been established specifically for the purpose of commercializing biobutanol, and our emphasis is on the gasoline market specifically. We're very interested in the state of Minnesota because of its deep and strong position in the ethanol industry. It provides us a platform, which I'll discuss later, on where we can very economically and rapidly develop and grow the biobutanol industry to the benefit of existing ethanol producers, existing corn farmers, as well as folks developing next-generation feedstocks for growing the biofuels industry beyond that. As previous witness stated, we cannot today sell biobutanol in the gasoline market in Minnesota the way current law is structured. With SF-448 provides provisions that add flexibility to the language, which gives us an option to compete for a place in the market. And as I'll describe, we think that will create substantial value for many people in the fuels value chain and consumers as well. So a quick history of Butamax. We were established in 2009, but our existence really dates back nearly a decade to when BP and DuPont got together to bring a new biofuel market molecule to the market. We've developed our technology, we've established a demonstration scale plant in England, and have been producing product there for a couple of years at small scale. With that, we've been able to thoroughly debug our technology, test it so that it will be commercially ready and robust, and put us in a place where we expect to break ground at a first retrofit facility, and our technology is a retrofit to existing plants. We'll talk more about that later, and have our first production at the end of 2014. So why butanol in the first place? So when BP and DuPont first came together, we put scientists from both sides in the room. We had biotech expertise from DuPont looking at all the advances that had happened in biotechnology over the past 20 years or so, and thinking, what are the new possibilities we can use these tools for in the fuels market to create greater value? And BP bringing the expertise of, these are the types of molecules that work well in fuel that help us take the benefits that ethanol delivers and build on them to allow the biofuels market, with the environmental benefits that it creates, to grow in a responsible way. So butanol is the molecule of choice because that is where those two circles, what you can make with biotechnology, what works well in fuel, that's where those two circles overlap. But to get into the marketplace, it takes much more, because the size of the fuel market dictates you need a way to get to scale. And getting to scale in the biotechnology world means I need abundant feedstocks. Not only the corn that is used today, economically, effectively, and efficiently, but also future feedstocks that may be developed economically in the future. So our technology ferments sugars to butanol. Those sugars initially will be from corn. In the long run, as technologies for converting cellulosic feedstocks such as corn stovers, switchgrass, wood, to fermentable sugars become commercial, our technology will marry up with those as well and grow the potential for increasing biofuel supply in the form of butanol. Another key to make that happen and get to this kind of scale that's needed for the fuels market quickly is an ability to deploy the technology at existing facilities. Much of the new biofuels technology is struggling to get to market because of the capital required to build greenfield facilities. Our technology is unique in that it can be retrofit to existing corn ethanol plants using the same feedstocks, using the same staff, using the same skill set that is required to run those plants economically, safely, reliably, but make a higher value product. Lastly, this is the fuels market. Cost is all important. We need the ability to yield a product that is cost competitive with ethanol in the fuels market. The way this bill is structured, we will have to be in a market where refiners will have a choice between ethanol and butanol. For them to select butanol and achieve its benefits, we have to be in a place where cost works for them and works for the consumer. That's a package that Butamax delivers and wants to be able to use in Minnesota. Thinking about all the other stakeholders in this, for oil companies, what butanol brings is the ability to actually lower their costs for producing the hydrocarbon portion of the gasoline. Does that because butanol has favorable blending properties, a low vapor pressure, high octane, favorable distillation, which altogether makes it lower cost and yields more gasoline from every barrel of crude. So we increase the efficiency of the fuels delivery system. Further, it works with the existing infrastructure. Butanol is not water-soluble, so it can be blended at the refinery, transported through pipeline in markets where that is the most efficient way to get there. It can be distributed through existing retail infrastructure as well. The automakers brings the benefit of being able to be blended at higher blend percentages with existing vehicles. The cars that are already on the road are already compatible with butanol blends of up to 16 volume percent, which is approved under an existing EPA waiver applicable to all vehicles. With that formulation, that 16% formulation, butanol, which has a higher energy density than ethanol, delivers the same greenhouse gas benefits, the same petroleum displacement benefits as would be delivered by a 20% ethanol blend, but it is approved today for use in all vehicles currently on the road, and it works with the retail infrastructure that is already in place. For policymakers looking to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, reduce dependence on crude, we see butanol as being a very efficient vehicle for making that happen and an effective one because it leverages the investment, the feedstocks, the people that are already in place in the biofuels industry today while creating a platform for further growth. For the biofuels producers, our technology is licensed to existing plant owners. They have the skills and the talent to run this industry better than anyone else possibly could. It allows them to take their existing asset with a modest additional investment and produce a higher value product and grow the market for what they do today using the same feedstocks they use today and additional feedstocks in the future. So what are we doing to actually get into the market?
Mr. Schubert, if you can wrap it up quickly, though, too, because we have a lot of bills. Good presentation, please.
Thank you. We've built our plant. We've tested it 1.5 million miles on a range of vehicles. We've supplied fuel at the Olympics last summer. A portion of the Olympic vehicle fleet was fueled with 24% butanol blend. We have an early adopters group ready to deploy the technology. That includes two plants based in Minnesota, High Water Ethanol and Granite Falls Energy in Granite, who are looking very closely as potential for deploying our technology. And we are working with Fagen Inc., the company that's built more ethanol plants than anyone else in the world, as implementing this solution. We're making great progress on delivering the regulatory approvals across all fronts to bring this to market. What we need in Minnesota is the ability to place our product to the market, and we believe that this bill gives us and gives the market the option to choose butanol if we are able to deliver the benefits that we claim. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Schubert. And Senator Sparks, you have one more person from the Mr. Jordan. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I am Brendan Jordan, Director of Bioenergy and Transportation Policy for the Great Plains Institute. I am testifying in favor of Senate File 448. I did have some prepared remarks. I will keep them short because I know the committee has a lot of business to attend to today. Why don't I just give a couple of very high-level comments? I did serve on the Biofuels Advisory Task Force, and my colleague serves on the NextGen Board. In that capacity, we support the recommendations that came out of both bodies that became the basis for this legislation. It was a multi-stakeholder effort that took into account the views of many different organizations, and I think the recommendations are stronger because of the fact that everyone was on board. They were unanimous coming out of both bodies. Why do we support this? I think a couple reasons I'll just list, one of which is greenhouse gas reduction. Transportation is the second largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota, in addition to doing the other things we need to do, like invest in transit and create more efficient vehicles. We do also need to make our fuels cleaner, and I believe that biofuels are one key path for Minnesota to have cleaner fuels. I think the second issue is embracing next-generation technology. I've been working in the biofuels, next-generation biofuels arena for a number of years. There are a number of facilities in other states that are under construction right now. If you look at Iowa, Mississippi, Louisiana, Florida, there are next-generation biofuel facilities that will use materials like crop residues, wood waste, and other materials. I think that this bill represents a step towards embracing next-gen biofuel technology. Minnesota did lead the nation in creating the first-generation biofuel industry, but as these facilities go into construction in other states, we risk losing our leadership role. Now, this bill clearly is not the only thing the state needs to do in order to commercialize next-generation advanced biofuels in the state. There will be some other steps that will need to be taken, but in our view, this bill is an important step in the right direction in overcoming a market barrier to access for certain advanced biofuels. I'll conclude my remarks right there. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate your time and happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jordan. Are there questions, comments, whatever from the committee? Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Sparks, you probably know where I'm going. We had the discussion yesterday about the amendment and a mutual agreement on language and what have you, and do we have that resolved at this point?
Mr. Chair and Senator Weber, as far as I know that Mr. Knopf has been working closely with those people. We can certainly ask if anyone else would want to testify on the bill. I believe that we were able to make some movement in that area, but we can certainly ask those folks if they'd like to come forward.
If anybody wants to, I understand you're continuing to talk and so on about this. Okay. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks, for those of us who haven't been in on the background, could you explain what some of the concerns are of the groups that we're waiting for?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, yesterday some of the retail gas stations had some issues with some of the labeling that would maybe be able to take place, and also had some other concerns, whether it was a mandate or a goal. And I think that we've made it clear to them that it was a goal. We did add a rather large amendment right before committee yesterday that I believe took away a majority of that heartburn.
So that, Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, the major concern is a labeling issue for gas stations?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I believe it was if it goes to an E15 level, it gets tougher for their tanks, their existing tanks, to meet that. And so there was some concerns with that. But I think by the amendment that we added, that gave them some comfort language. And then we can certainly bring the petroleum folks up if you'd like to hear a further discussion on that topic.
Senator Benson, you there?
Mr. Chair, I have other questions.
Go ahead. Right now, nobody else has raised their hand, so go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Sparks. Would biofuel include algae?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, biofuel in the bill is defined the same way as U.S. EPA defines it, and so it would require, so an algae-based biofuel could qualify if it meets the EPA pathway approval.
To do this, we made it generic, so any fuel today or in the future would meet that definition.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, with that, there's ethanol. There's the isobutanol. Are there other fuels that we're looking at coming online? Because right now we'd be looking at a gasoline ethanol isobutanol blend. Would there be other things, and to what extent would that have to be disclosed?
So there's a company named Virent who's out of Madison, Wisconsin, that's using a technology to convert sugars directly to gasoline. That would be included in this definition of biofuels. Kior, who's currently taking woody material and going through a thermochemical process to convert it to a biocrude and then refining that biocrude today. They're doing that. I think their plant right now is done in Mississippi. And so that biocrude, that gasoline from that biocrude would meet this definition of biofuel. Those are the ones that are directly related to gasoline.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the language here is written around the gasoline market. Biodiesel is covered by separate laws, I understand.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and I see part of the amendment is that we're reaching a specific portion of total gasoline, not total liquid fuel. Is that where we're making the distinction, so biodiesel isn't impacted by this?
That's correct.
And, Mr. Chair, I don't know if any of the testifiers would be able to help me with this, but did we learn anything from not making the 2015 goal, and are we putting things in place to fix that so that these other goals become achievable, and we don't have to come back in 5 years and say, okay, we're not close, and then amend the statute again. What did we learn, and how did we miss it?
Well, I think, Senator Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, you know, what we want to do here is try to encourage more biofuels and more biochemical companies to consider making those investments in Minnesota while protecting the investments that we've made in ethanol. So I really believe that by bringing this legislation forward, we'll open that market up, and then hopefully, like I said, we've got some goals that we certainly would like to hit, but we did not make them a mandate for that very reason.
And making it generic is what really is a powerful tool here, because it doesn't matter what the molecule is, any biofuel can help meet that mandate. And I think that's really one of the learnings we had when we initially it was only related to one molecule. Now it's open to every biofuel that can be made.
Senator Benson.
Chair, I think I'm the only one with questions.
That's
so
okay.
I'll keep this short. Right now, cars are approved to a 16% isobutanol blend, I believe was the testimony. Just for my family, so this is a little bit selfish, I already answered my biodiesel question. My husband has a collector car, a muscle car. What happens to the fuel for those kinds of cars? Are they going to be behind this? Do we need to keep special blends on the market?
So to answer your question, isobutanol is not it, because of its longer chain length, it acts like a hydrocarbon. It stays in the gasoline portion. It is not soluble in the water portion. And so this will act like a traditional gasoline, and it'll run like gasoline. We have done extensive testing on legacy marine fleet engines as well as small engines with the 16% blends, and all of this is in public record as far as the National Marine Association is concerned, as far as the outdoor power and equipment, and they say that this material runs fine in their legacy vehicles. So based on that, I would say your husband's muscle car will be just fine.
Yeah, if I may add to that, the existing exemptions from the E10 mandate that are currently available to provide fuel for older vehicles and so forth remain in effect.
And this bill is not changing those exemptions. Right. Other questions? Senator Coonan?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the bill.
Senator Coonan moves that Senate File 448, we did not amend it further, be recommended to pass. And are there any other committees? I'm told we don't know of any who have asked us for it.
Okay, so I know we had some discussions, but I think that's fine, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 448 has been recommended to pass. Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Tomasoni is in the room.
24%.
See, we've got all these resorts, marinas, those are the requirements.
I don't know.
So, Jersey gas stations sell Jersey American straight gas. But they have to be only. Not all gas.
I can see why.
Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the committee. Welcome to the committee. I understand you may have an author's amendment.
Oh, yes, Mr. Chairman, we have an author's amendment, and I think Mr. Fuller has to make a technical change.
Okay, and is that the A3 amendment? That the A3 amendment, the author's amendment? Okay, and Mr. Fuller had some word additions to it.
Mr. Chair, members, it's the A3 amendment. If you'll see on line 1.2 of the amendment, it strikes some language. That language appears in the new amendment as well in the bill, so we'll have to strike it. So it would be page 3, line 19, delete the Minnesota jurisdictional portion of. So the same language as the old language that's stricken upstairs, up above on line 1.2.
So could you repeat in the bill, page 3, line 19?
Delete the Minnesota jurisdictional portion of.
Okay. So it would read the language, to recover from its Minnesota retail customers the amounts paid. Okay. Senator Thomasoni, you wanted that as part of the author's amendment. Senator Coonan moves the A3 amendment with that oral change incorporated. Okay, is there any discussion? This is an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Thomasoni, on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Senate File 521 relates to the Laurentian Energy Authority, which is a joint venture that was created for the public utilities of the cities of Virginia and Hibbing, and it was created by the legislature in 2005 to convert our coal-burning municipal power plants to biomass. And since 2007, the Laurentian Energy Authority has annually provided XL Energy with 35 megawatts of renewable biomass energy in order to meet XL's legislatively mandated biomass requirement passed in 1994 as a part of the Prairie Island Agreement. What we're doing here today is that several years ago, our communities began the task of diversifying our economy as well as trying to become a more green economy. And as you know, the Iron Range is a mining-based and logging-based economy, and we have made a very conscious decision to realize that someday these particular resources may not be around anymore to fuel our economy, and so have tried to do some diversification as far as our economy is concerned. Some of the things that we've done, I'm not going to mention, but I am going to mention the things that we're doing here in regards to green and renewable energy. And the first thing we did was create this Laurentian Energy Authority, which is reducing the amount of coal that is used at both Virginia and Hibbing in order to utilize biomass. We also commissioned in Mountain Iron, Minnesota Power put up 10 of the biggest windmills in the state and created on the Continental Divide right outside of MinTac. And the third thing we did was we made a solar manufacturing plant on the Iron Range. So they're all renewable and all green, and they were also for job creation as well as retaining jobs. Senate File 521 is a bill that helps these projects. They're renewable energy plants because in 2005, when the legislature created this, the communities invested over $90 million in order to make the conversion from the coal fire plants to the biomass plants. The investment itself saved about 150 people's jobs at these facilities and an additional 47 loggers who's will provide the biomass instead of importing the coal from Wyoming, 387 commercial customers and 2,528 residential customers in both Virginia and Hibbing use this renewable biomass steam heat to heat their homes and businesses, and XL Energy purchases the 35 megawatts of renewable biomass electric energy annually from these plants. The problem has been, however, the plants operate under a fixed 20-year price guideline, and there are two legislatively mandated biomass plants that XL purchases energy from, and they have a fuel adjustment clause, but the Laurentian Energy does not have a fuel adjustment clause. So with this legislation, what we would do is allow Laurentian Energy to have a fuel adjustment clause and be treated exactly the same way as the other biomass facilities are in the state. And with me today are Terry Leone, the general manager of the Laurentian Energy Authority, and Mayor Louis Russo from Virginia. And they have some, you want to testify or do you want to just answer questions?
You're welcome to give a brief statement if you want. Please identify yourself, and if so, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Senator Thomasoni. Please excuse me. I have a cold and the flu both simultaneously.
Oh, good. So. He didn't tell me that before.
I see Senator Thomasoni slowly.
Mr. Chair, can I have a different seat, please?
Senator Thomasoni covered the history pretty well. You all realize this all stemmed from the 1994 Prairie Island legislation. The communities of Hibbing and Virginia, Hibbing population 17,000, Virginia population 8,500, two municipal communities in the state of Minnesota, took a considerable amount of risk and took on a considerable amount of debt to accomplish the third named project in the Prairie Island legislation for renewable energy. We took over this project officially took it over in 2005. And at that point in time, our power purchase agreement, our PPA with Xcel, was almost virtually pre-negotiated for us, and we had very little latitude to change that contract. And in that, we did ask for a price adjustment in 2005, but Xcel found clear not to negotiate that with us. You might also remember that in 2009, we were before this body asking for a price increase. We did not ask for a fuel adjustment because we wanted to work with Xcel through that. And I was asked by then Representative Tori Westrum if I did not think we would be back here again asking for a fuel price adjustment. I told him yes, and here we are again. What's happening with fuel prices, I think everybody in this room is well aware. So a fixed price contract only goes so far in allowing the two communities to keep abreast of their operating costs. And therefore, we, besides the price increase, we need the fuel adjustment. So again, I will just conclude my comments by saying that the purpose of this legislation is to direct Xcel Energy to negotiate a contract at the price authorized by the legislature in 2009, to add a fuel adjustment clause similar to the other two legislatively mandated biomass plants in both St. Paul District Energy and Benson, the Fibroman project, and to resolve annual production limitations to increase operational flexibility. And with that, I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Sir, did you wish to, Mayor?
Mr. Chairman, no. My name is Louis Russo. I'm the mayor of Virginia. And I was one of those people who voted yes to go ahead with this biomass project based on the fact that Xcel was supposed to be purchasing the power. $90 million for the communities of Hibbing and Chisholm, or Hibbing and Virginia's, is an awful lot of money. And I think that we are all assured that that money would be repaid by the purchase.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, did you have any other witnesses? I see Xcel wants to speak.
Mr. Evans wants to say something.
Yeah.
So.
Mr. Evans, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I feel like I'm taking typhoid Terry's seat. Let the record show, I also shook his hand.
Let the record show, now he sat on both sides.
Mr. Chair, my name's Rick Evans. I'm with Government Affairs for Xcel Energy. Senator Tomasoni and the other witnesses have already covered most of the points I wanted to make. I think with the possible exception of the chair, there are not other members of the committee that have seen the history of the 1994 mandate and how we progressed. And I did want to put this particular contract in the context, though I think the Senator Tomasoni and the other witnesses have already done that. I do want to point out that as a result of the 1994 mandate, Xcel has three biomass contracts. They were described accurately by the other witnesses. Fibromin, which burns turkey manure down in Benson, Minnesota, is a 55-megawatt plant. The St. Paul Cogen plant, which burns wood, is a 25-megawatt plant, and then this project is a 35-megawatt plant. The 1994 mandate was essentially an experiment in biomass. It was one of the first mandates in the state of Minnesota, and it was a very expensive technology back in 1994. And as we see with the bill that's before us today, it's still an expensive technology. And we wanted to point that out. There was another experiment that was started back in 1994, and that was the wind experiment. And I think it's worth noting that the Department of Commerce recently testified at the PUC that the average of these three biomass contracts is about 16 cents a kilowatt hour, a little under that. The average of our wind contracts, or I should say the current wind contracts that we get, are about 4 cents a kilowatt hour. So I think it's fair to say that in the 1994 experiment, the wind experiment has been a success, and at least for our utility. It's not uniformly across the board, but on our utility, it's been a success. Biomass has been less of a success, and it was the one thing I guess I wanted to note about this contract is that the good news was that the 1994 experiment was a modest one. It was a cautious one. We moved forward with the technology to see how it worked. In this case, not so well. In the case of wind, considerably better. And we'd recommend this model as a something to follow as the legislature considers the advancement of new technologies in energy. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Questions from members of the committee? Senator Benson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Evans, as you said, I'm very new to this, and I need help understanding items like page 2, line 29, the public utility shall agree, and the amendment must be negotiated. It doesn't feel like a negotiation with must and shall, so please help me understand in context what this means, because right now this doesn't feel fair.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I think the best way I can describe it is that the contract was entered into not because it was the best business deal for a utility to make at the time it was entered into. It was entered into as a matter by the direction of public policy that was trying to give our, you know, put our toe in the water in this particular technology, burning biomass. The contract was negotiated. This particular contract was much more legislatively driven, frankly, than the other two contracts that we had because of the way in which this project was developed. But as Mr. Leonis testified, and as Senator Tomasoni, I think, referred to, this project is not able to survive on the contract that they negotiated. They need the fuel pass-through, and I don't say this in my own knowledge. I just take them at their word. They need the fuel pass-through, and they need this price in order to survive. They made the investments they made in response to public policy. We entered the contract that we made in response to public policy, and as it happens, unfortunately, in this case, it requires policymakers to fix the contract. We, of course, have to have all of our contracts approved by the Public Utilities Commission, and frankly, the project came to us earlier on and asked if we'd be willing to voluntarily enter into a new contract, and our judgment was that we would not be able to take a new contract to the Public Utilities Commission and necessarily have it approved. It was not a risk we were willing to run, and so that's why the need for this legislation here. I expect that many of the terms of the contract, as you point out, are going to be more or less, you know, set by the legislature. But in the case of a project that was, frankly, came into existence because of the legislature, I guess that's going to be your job this time.
So, Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Evans, so if you brought this deal to the PUC, you believe it would be rejected because of its impact on rates, or?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, certainly don't speak for the PUC, and I'm not sure anybody can at this point. The PUC's job, as directed by the state, is to provide our customers with lowest cost energy, the most reliable, low cost energy. That's their charter. And so they are not it's not their job to implement these other parts of public policy. That's what the legislature's job is. And so it's not so much that we were sure they wouldn't agree to it or they wouldn't approve it. It's simply not, I guess maybe the best way to say it is they look at contracts that we sign to find reliable, low-cost energy, and that's what, and we weren't sure that this would necessarily pass muster. It just wasn't something we were willing to go into the legislature and seek. Into the Public Utilities Commission and seek.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I should point out Senator Benson. One of the reasons we're here is because there's two other projects just like it, and they both have fuel adjustment clauses, so they can increase the amount that they're getting paid, whereas this one doesn't have a fuel adjustment clause, and that's what we're seeking today. And there's 14 years left on the contract, and so in order to make sure that this thing cash flows, they need to have the fuel adjustment clause because of the changes in the fuel costs over the years.
And Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni. So why weren't all these modeled after each other so that there was a fuel adjustment clause, so that there was kind of a standard set for this type of energy transmission?
Well, I think that's why we're here, because we made a mistake on that. But
Mr. Chair, Senator, there was no mistake made. We were not allowed to negotiate a fuel adjustment in 2005 when we concluded our PPA negotiations with Xcel. We even came back here to this body in 2009 and asked for it. And again, we agreed with Xcel not to go after it that hard, a fuel adjustment mechanism, because of the sensitivity to pricing by the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. Now today, with escalating fuel costs, we are forced to go forward and ask for a fuel adjustment.
And I don't want to, Mr. Chair, and I don't want to put words in Xcel's mouth, but I think what they're saying is that if we tell them to do it, they're willing to do it, but they really don't want to have to go in front of the PUC and ask for it.
Mr. Chair, I'll just say, if you tell us to do it, we're going to do it whether we want to or not.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chair, just for context, the 35 megawatts our contract represents is only 0.38% of 1% of Xcel Energy's load. So when you start talking about the cost to the ratepayer, I believe it's pretty insignificant, having been in the utility industry for the last 15 years. And there have been articles printed recently on the fact that projects like this do not increase the cost to the ratepayer.
Further discussion? That's Senator Keene. Want to move the bill? Senator Coonan, want to move the bill? Somebody want to move the bill? Senator Scalzi. Okay. Senator Scalzi moves Senate file 521 be recommended to pass. And Senator Thomas, you don't know of any other committees for this bill?
I haven't been asked to go to another committee, no.
As amended.
Senate file 521 as amended. Senator Scalzi moves that for Senate file 521. Any discussion on that? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very
Chair.
Much.
Thank you very
Senator,
much, committee members.
Thank you all. Senator Sparks's bill, his staff came here to tell us that, after all, state and local does want to see his bill. So we'll bring that bill up again. Senator Coonan moves that we reconsider the motion which we passed 448 to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And moves that instead that Senate file 448 be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on State and Local Governments. Is there a discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Those opposed? I'm sorry. Motion prevails. Now Senate file 680, Senator Eaton. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the, it's a delete all, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a delete all A1 amendment that everybody, I had it in my packet.
Okay, it's in the packets. So it is. Senator Eat moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape she'd like to work from. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. This is a solar energy jobs bill, and it has a number of solar energy provisions, and including a mandate that 10% of the electricity in Minnesota be generated with solar technology by 2030. So I will ask my
present your witnesses.
Witnesses here to. Go ahead. You want to start?
Who wants to go first?
Introduce
Welcome
yourself.
To the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. My name is John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and I will give you sort of a high-level overview of the most important components of this legislation. And you'll find it. You'll have found in your packet what looks like a PowerPoint presentation. Rather than put it on the screen, there should be 7 slides. That will guide you through this, but if not, I'm more than happy to just give that overview. So the top slide is descriptively named the Solar Energy Jobs Act of 2013, and we'll dive right in on slide 2. to the main component, as mentioned
members,
by Senator Eaton.
Excuse me, Mr. Farrell. It's, for members, it's the gray photocopy thing that's horizontal. Go ahead, Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the basic element here is, as Senator Eaton mentioned, a 10% solar energy standard, much like the current renewable electricity standard. The goal is to meet strong ratepayer interest in adding solar to the energy mix, as well as to accommodate a modest goal for increasing ramping up solar energy in comparison to other state solar energy standards, scaling up to a goal of 10% electricity from solar energy in 2030, which falls slightly short of the U.S. Department of Energy's SunShot goal of 14% electricity from solar by 2030. So that's the basic provision in this legislation. On the next page is the second major component, which is a focus on broad participation. The bill aims to give Minnesota residents and businesses a chance to go solar and Minnesota companies a chance to manufacture and install it. So what you see in the chart there is the goal of the legislation would be to distribute, to get a variety of solar system sizes and a variety of locations from the solar energy that would be produced under the standard. And it would mean solar ultimately on more than 50,000 rooftops across the state, from cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul to Duluth to Farmington, Red Wing, all over the state. The next component is payment for production. I like to sum up this section of the bill as if you don't produce any kilowatt hours, you don't get any cash. And the first crucial component of that is called the value of solar. There's a further description of this component on one of the portrait-oriented handouts at the end of the presentation that gives a line-by-line description. But rather than get into that level of detail, I would just like to say that this value of solar calculation is based on one that is used by the Austin Energy Municipal Utility in Texas. It uses several major components that calculate essentially a market value of solar to the utility based on its technological production profile. You can see in the chart what that value of solar has been to the utility. It's a non-subsidy value. It's just the market value of solar based on the electricity it provides and the time of day that it provides it to that utility. And this bill would require that kind of calculation by Minnesota utilities. It would also essentially split for folks who are solar energy producers they would have 2 meters instead of just 1 meter. The utility would be buying all of the solar energy produced at that facility as measured by 1 meter. They would also, the customer would continue to buy all, or to, excuse me, the utility would continue to sell all the electricity that customer normally uses on a traditional electricity meter, which would allow them to recover their fixed costs. The second part of the payment for production is on the next slide. Again, it's a production-based incentive under that philosophy that if you don't produce electricity, you won't be receiving payment. It aligns with ratepayer willingness to pay, which you can see in the chart on the left across the political spectrum, with a relatively modest cost over the life of the program. The bill allows for a surcharge on electricity bills of up to 1.33%. You can see in the chart that that is less than $1 per month per residential customer, and it also is about 1/6 the cost of the electricity rate increase that was recently adopted by Xcel Energy. This production-based incentive would be a replacement for upfront rebates, again, to focus on a per kilowatt-hour incentive. It would be based on project size. So like I mentioned in the second slide about a broad-based participation, there would be a variety of solar system sizes and locations, and the price would be different depending on the size of the solar installation. And this incentive would ultimately phase out over time as the cost of solar continues to fall. It would also, the bill would also include a bonus for Minnesota-made materials in the use of solar projects with a recognition of their higher economic value. On the next slide, you can see kind of the ultimate concept then here is a sort of simplified solar, that we are helping to accelerate the decline of the cost of solar by lowering transaction costs and the cost of financing. And the mechanism by which that's done is combining those two production-based payments, the value of solar and the production-based incentive. Solar generators would sign a standardized contract that would be the same among all utility service territories and to deliver that electricity at this combined price for 20 years. So they get a 20-year fixed price. And this simple, transparent revenue stream for a solar generator makes it very easy for them to go out and attract private capital, which is ultimately where all of the money will come from for the vast majority of the solar installations under this legislation. The last slide is really just the bottom line on the Solar Energy Jobs Act. It looks at the overall generation of electricity under the standard and the number of rooftops it would cover, the number of jobs and the amount of economic activity as modeled by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory's JEDI economic model, and, of course, the millions of dollars in projected energy savings for Minnesota homes and businesses that would be able to install solar energy under this legislation. And the bottom line of the bottom line is that for every dollar in public financed incentives, it buys about $5 in economic output. Thank you, members of the committee. And Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Should we just continue with the witnesses right now?
Sure, Mr. Chair. This is Lynn Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Lynn Hinkle. I am policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. Our members represent the entire solar value chain in Minnesota. I need to make sure that I don't leave out our utility members. I neglected to mention Xcel and GRE as members of MNSEA in our House testimony, and wanted to make sure right away that I didn't make the same mistake this time. We also have members who are manufacturers, original equipment manufacturers, supply chain component material manufacturers, small installers, as well as large project developers, and you're going to hear more from those folks in just a minute. We also have representation from labor unions, trainers, and a variety of other folks in the value chain of solar in Minnesota. If I could urge you to turn to one of the pieces of material that was included in your packet. It's a letter from Executive Director of the Blue-Green Alliance, David Foster. I'm not going to go over the entire letter, but if you would turn your attention to the third paragraph, I think it's noteworthy that in addition to reducing carbon, implementing a 10% by 2030 solar standard will be good for Minnesota's economy. This is a theme you're going to hear over and over as we go forward with our testimony today. Already, there are more than 100 businesses in the state in all facets of the solar industry. We can bolster those businesses and attract new ones by providing market certainty for these companies to invest in our state. 7 of the 10 fastest-growing solar states based on solar capacity in 2011 have solar energy standards in place. In total, there are 16 other states with these standards. Passing the Solar Energy Jobs Act is one of the key policy steps that Minnesota legislators can take to ensure the growth of this important industry in our state. I'll conclude my comments by simply noting that this bill goes after the development of two market opportunities. The first market opportunity John spoke of earlier, which is the value of solar rate, which quantifies the benefit to ratepayers for the installation of solar. The second market opportunity is equally important, and that is the potential to grow solar manufacturing in our state with the implementation of an incentive for Made in Minnesota. With that, I conclude my remarks and open for any questions at this point, unless you want to just proceed with the testimony.
Somebody to go through the bill.
You do.
Can we do that?
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Lynn's going to go through a brief walk through the bill.
Walk through the bill. Thank you. Okay.
The first section of the bill deals with the rate setting. It's pretty much the boilerplate that you would see up to the subdivision 6C, where we set up a solar energy production incentive. This is similar but different to what we've seen in the past with the REPI, but this is the solar energy production incentive. The second subdivision, or section four of the bill, walks through the formulas that we're suggesting be applied for determining the value of solar rate. It discusses the interconnection, the standard contract that would be put in place as a result of the calculation of the value of solar rate. Subdivision 6, as I indicated, talks about the formulas, the components, if you will, of what would then be aggregated into the value of solar rate. It includes seven different components. The seventh, you'll note, is the economic development benefits. The process of developing the value of solar rate is laid out in the subsequent subdivisions. It's noteworthy that we engage stakeholders, particularly the utilities, in this process. The approval process first goes to the Division of Energy Resources for review, their approval of the calculation. It then moves from DER, Division of Energy Resources, to the PUC for their approval. The next portion of the bill, Section 5, deals with the actual energy standard, the solar energy standard. And you see the ramp that is suggested for the installation starting. It would actually start in 2014, and proceed to 2030. There are actually benchmarks for every year, but for the sake of the legislation, we've indicated these, so it would be easier for people to understand initially. There's the authority to issue a refund in the event that one is necessary. In the next section, we talk about including large solar electric generating plants in the standard. The Section 8 talks about the ability to pool resources. This is essentially including the solar energy standard in provisions that have been in statute. The solar energy production incentive account is established, and it lays out the definitions. It's noteworthy that, as John indicated before, this establishes a common contract for the purchase and use of the solar energy production incentive account. The solar energy production incentive is the next portion of the bill. The incentive payment is articulated in the provisions of this section. We stipulate in this section of the bill the duration of contracts of no greater than 20 years. There is a discussion in this portion of the bill that pertains to the development of a so-called reference price. We did not put those in the bill. We believe that the process that we've articulated in this subdivision is adequate to the development of that reference price. As we understand, the market will be changing, and there'll be price reductions that would have to be taken into account in the resetting of that reference price. Now we're completed with the essential provisions of the bill. There remain at the end of the bill provisions for four studies. Section 11 is the study of potential for solar energy installations on public buildings. Want to understand what are the rooftop and adjacent properties.
Excuse me, Mr. Hinkle. Senator Dibble?
I think that's section 13.
He's going off the original bill. I think it's okay. Delete everything. I noticed that earlier.
I apologize if that's confusing. I'll just say that there are four studies at the end of the bill. The first study is the study of potential for solar energy installations on public buildings. We had considerable discussion about this last year, mostly in the context of what we were doing with the Renewable Development Fund, and we believe there was value in our continuing to ascertain the potential for solar on public buildings in the state. There's a solar interconnection study. We think that this is a value add, that it's important for the utilities and DER to determine where in the grid is it most beneficial to place solar energy installations. We know that a lot of this data is available, but we think that it would be helpful for that data to be aggregated, and that's the purpose of this study. There's a third study, the value of on-site energy storage. Again, we're attempting to understand the value that energy storage can add to essentially the peak energy generating capacity that solar is so abundantly available to produce. This would add to that capacity, and we believe that it's important to understand that and begin to understand where the costs of what are the price points in relation to solar that need to be understood in developing this market. And the fourth is the value of solar thermal study. We did not include solar thermal conversions in this bill. We think that it's important going forward for those conversion factors to be understood, and it's our hope that this study would provide us a basis for that understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle. By the way, for members of the committee, we are going to be looking at putting together an omnibus energy bill, and the intent today would be to have the testimony on this bill and then lay it over for possible inclusion into that bill. But I wonder if you want to just continue on with your list of witnesses.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Hinkle, for going through that.
Hope I didn't go too rapidly. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Welcome to the committee, and go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Ralph Jacobson. I am the owner and founder of Innovative Power Systems, a solar installer and developer in St. Paul. We reversed our order here with your permission, I guess I should say. We're going to go from smaller to larger. And I represent the small business. Nathan will represent the larger businesses. So if that makes sense, I will continue. I started my business in 1991. I guess I jumped in early. And so in those 22 years that I have been in the solar business in Minnesota, I have seen the price of a solar panel go from $15 a watt to around $1 a watt. You can't say that for many pieces of technology today. I've also employed over 50 people in my business during that time, not all at the same time. And a great frustration to me is that I've had to let most of them go because it's been a real rocky road running a solar business in Minnesota. It's been a very capricious market, very little in terms of policy underpinnings. If you look at the places where I have been buying my equipment over the last 20 years, it's been from supply houses on the West Coast or the East Coast. The manufacturers would be in Germany, Japan, California, Massachusetts. And all of those places are, I would say, you could characterize by saying that they have cultivated their solar industry. And it's not an accident that I've been buying equipment from those manufacturers in those places. They were willing, they saw the promise of solar, and they were willing to, encourage manufacturing, encourage the local industry. Each of those places has a vigorous local industry, which provides a good feedback mechanism for the manufacturers. And that's why Germany, with two-thirds the solar resource that Minnesota has, is one of the major exporters of solar technology in the world. It's not because of their great solar resource. It's because they have a vision. And so what I notice as technology filters in, that there's a lot of swirl of chaos. We have a very rich incentive program, which is probably going to be quite a bit different in 2 years. And yet right now, the worldwide market is measured in gigawatts. The production of solar panels, would be thousands of megawatts of capacity. And it's pretty large, and it's growing. In 10 years, it's going to be terawatts. That's going to be millions of megawatts. And the question is, that we're trying to address is, when is it time for Minnesota to jump in to that industry for real? It's been very frustrating for me to, be in business in the policy situation that we have. It seems like what we're doing with this bill overall is creating a much more rational way of looking at solar energy, where we have quantified categories where we quantify the attributes of solar energy. And I think we've learned something from the renewable energy standard experience around wind, in which a lot of installation occurred in Minnesota, but a lot of the manufacturing went to Iowa. We don't want to repeat that in Minnesota. We want to develop the manufacturing capacity here. And so developing a robust industry means balanced, having education, having an installation base, good feedback mechanism for the local manufacturers. And so we have several manufacturers here. We have a lot of the pieces of the supply chain. And I guess the vision that we're putting forward is that we can, with good policy underpinning, put them together. And instead of the world saying, uh-oh, here comes Minnesota, they're going to be, hallelujah, here comes Minnesota, because we're going to be coming at them with good products, good ideas, and a vision. And so I think that the only thing I want to say is that we are setting up a framework that uses market signals to drive the economic and industrial development that Minnesota needs in order to be a significant player in the national and global market. And this bill is not intended to be overly prescriptive, but instead to create a process. So I hope that you're focusing on, developing good process for good relationships to develop between the natural partners, who are the utilities themselves, the industry, the customers, the regulators. And we really want to see this work for everyone. And so, as Lynn mentioned, we want to see that the different types of utilities, like the munis, the co-ops, and the investor-owned utilities, are able to plug their economics into the formula and create something that works for them. Because we realize that they have to report back to their constituency, whether it's voters, members, or investors. And so I hope that you will take a lot of the provisions of this bill into the omnibus. And with that, I'll invite any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Davidson. Mr. Franz.
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Nathan Franz, and I'm the Director of Solar for Geronimo Energy. We are an Edina-based wind and solar developer. We focus on commercial and utility-scale projects. I've been in the solar industry for the past 5 years and have worked on over 100 projects in 17 states, and currently own and operate over 1 megawatt of solar in the state of Minnesota. I'm here to testify that the time is now to act on the solar legislation in Minnesota. As many people have testified, prices continue to fall and have brought solar in line with the value of energy it offsets in the marketplace. In 2009, when we installed the St. John Solar Farm, it was installed for a cost of $7 a watt. Today, that same system can be installed for around $2 a watt, a 70% drop in installed cost in just the last 4 years. When we combine this dramatic decline in installed costs with the fact that solar energy offsets new peaking capacity investments while also producing valuable on-peak energy, you can start to see why the economics of solar are so rapidly changing. This point is illustrated by the fact that in other states, we are regularly seeing solar compete and win in open source RFPs with other forms of new peaking generators such as natural gas. In Minnesota, the blended and capacity rate in 2011, as reported by FERC, for two of our peaking facilities was in excess of $250 a blended megawatt hour. Solar displaces this high-priced energy and capacity. In fact, the two systems that we own and operate had an 80% capacity factor over the last 3 years during all top five super peaks. Passing comprehensive solar legislation now will allow us to lock in Minnesota jobs before they take root in other areas of the country, and it will allow us to take advantage of the favorable federal tax code before changes take effect in 2016. Fortunately, Minnesota has a successful model it can replicate. The solar industry is in roughly the same place that the wind industry was in the late 1990s when Minnesota took a step to become a national leader in the wind industry with the enactment of the renewable standards. Therefore, we support a reasonable solar standard that targets acquiring projects at the lowest installed cost and supports all three unique market segments, namely the residential, commercial, and utility-scale solar markets. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We look forward to working with the committee on this and other related bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Franzen. Mr. Snope? Mr. Noble next? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. My name is Andrew Snope. I'm a business representative with IBEW Local 292, the Electricians Union in Minneapolis. The IBEW represents thousands of workers in the electrical industry throughout the state, and in Minneapolis we represent about 5,000 of them, Minneapolis, St. Cloud, and the Willmar area. IBEW Local 292 supports this bill. We see this as an opportunity to put our qualified and competent members to work. IBEW electricians have been trained and certified to construct, install, and maintain solar energy systems. We have our own state-of-the-art privately funded training facility that we have been and continue to train electricians, apprentices in the ever-growing solar industry. We train apprentices through the day school program, and we train journey level and master electricians through continuing education in the evening on weekends. There are several electrical contractors throughout the state that employ our members, and together we have formed a partnership ready to work and support the energy standards. The largest solar project in the state, the IKEA store in Bloomington, was installed by IBEW electricians. The incentives in this bill and the goals will help encourage contractors to take on more of this work, and we can provide the qualified individuals to work on those projects. Our industry has suffered with downturn in the economy. We have had many electricians out of work for several years. These kind of incentives and goals will help put electricians back to work while also providing green, renewable energy resources as additional sources of energy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Snow. Mr. Noble, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Michael Noble. I'm the executive director at Fresh Energy, an energy policy group in St. Paul, and we enthusiastically support Senator Eaton's Solar Energy Jobs Act. The purpose of the act, Mr. Chairman, is to establish Minnesota as a North American leader in the solar energy industry, joining other places like Texas and Colorado and New Jersey and Ontario. With this bill, we can grow businesses and jobs in all aspects of the industry, the engineering, the installation, the manufacture, all of whom are represented here today. The bill intends to create open and competitive markets for different kinds of business models, small solar installers serving homes and neighborhood businesses, large electrical contractors that serve commercial interests, and Minnesota's largest construction companies building solar farms like the one you see on Xcel Energy system as you drive into the Detroit airport. This vision we have of a 10% part of our electric mix in solar power is quite modest compared to the United States Department of Energy's goal that we have 14% nationwide by 2030. Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu said this week that solar energy would be the cheapest form of electric generation within a decade. The bill's been modeled after the 2007 Renewable Energy Standard, a policy tool the committee knows quite well. There are 29 states that have renewable energy standards. 15 of those 29 have a solar energy set-aside or solar energy requirement or an additional standard that supports solar or local energy. The problem with the renewable energy standards from the point of view of a solar installer, is that literally no solar energy was driven, no solar investment was driven by the renewable energy standard, and it was not designed to be. The renewable energy standard was designed to make sure that renewable energy was acquired at the very lowest cost. And solar energy is not right now the very, very lowest cost, although it soon will be. So what this bill does is it creates opportunities in all these different business models to grow solar energy industry and not have to compete head-to-head with wind power in the renewable standard. And as proof of that point, over $10 billion of private capital is invested in Minnesota and a neighboring state serving Minnesota to meet the renewable energy standard, or will be between 2007 and 2025. About $10 billion of investment is driven. The solar energy business, the solar energy installations in Minnesota right now is only about $50 million, very, very, very small, only about 10 or 15 megawatts total. The reason why solar energy is not moving in Minnesota is it's very, very, the way utilities are structured, it's not advisable for them even put their toe in the water. Mr. Evans explained why utilities don't work on biomass, because the incentives and the structures not encourage them to do that. They only do it in response to public policy. And so no utility in Minnesota wants to do any more than just dabble ever so slightly in solar energy, because there's nothing in the law that would encourage them to do so. If we could get a solar energy standard using this bill, what we'll do is we'll pay solar energy producers what solar energy is really worth. And the second thing we'll do is we'll create an incentive pool to support the solar energy projects that are not quite the cheapest solar energy projects, these large industrial solar farms that could be out by the airport or out on vacant land or in landfills. We need to support all different kinds of business models, whether it's mom-and-pop contractors with a pickup truck serving homeowners, or these large electrical contractors with organized labor, with high levels of unemployment in the IBEW. We need to support all the different kinds of business models, and this bill does it. And it does it by setting aside a fund using just 1.3% of gross receipts or gross utility revenues to cover these incentives. And it builds this thing we're calling the value of solar tariff. That's jargon. What it really means is paying the solar energy producer what the solar energy is really worth. And it's intuitive what solar energy is really worth. It's not just electricity, but it's electricity on peak demand when the sun is shining on the hottest day of the year when everybody's all hands on deck and need all the power you can get. So it's peak power. And it's local power, right at the place where the power is used, so there's not any need for power line poles in the alley, there's not any need for transmission lines across the country, there's no line losses from transmission, so it's power delivered right where power is needed. So it's peak power, local power, and there's four or five other ideas in the bill how we're going to add up the actual true value of solar and pay it what it's worth. And lastly, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Fresh Energy came to support this bill after very long deliberation and study. All of the work our organization has done since 1990 has been built on the bedrock principle of least cost energy. Energy efficiency is least cost. Wind energy combined with natural gas is the least cost resource. And solar energy is not a least cost resource. Solar energy will soon be a least cost resource, but not yet. So we're here today asking this committee to give a leg up, give an opportunity to get the solar industry started in Minnesota to capture many of these benefits of economic opportunity, clean energy, diversifying our mix, driving jobs, having local power. The community is overwhelmingly supportive of this idea of power from the sun with free from fuel charges forever. This is a very, very powerful idea. And if we build this vigorous, competitive, renewable energy solar business in Minnesota, that will be the single largest thing we can do to drive down the cost of solar. As a previous testimony mentioned, the United States Department of Energy is entirely focused on driving down the cost of solar to about $1 a watt. And Stephen Chu thinks that that can be accomplished within approximately a decade. Why would we be left behind while other countries and other states and other innovative policymakers capture the benefits, capture the value of an explosive industry
that will be one of the world's largest industries in producing electricity in the not-distant future. Why would Minnesota be left behind? So two kinds of costs to solar power, the panels themselves, in which the prices are dropping precipitously, and all the other costs, which people call the soft costs, the labor costs, the number of hours, the red tape, the bureaucracy, getting the permits, getting interconnected to the grid. And reducing this hassle factor, reducing these costs is another important policy consideration. We can achieve all those things, but first we have to have is a market, and the renewable energy standard is not serving that market, but a solar energy standard will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. One question. I think when the previous witnesses said when he started, it was like $15 a watt, and it's now it's gone down exponentially, it seems, in the last decade. And I notice in the goals you have on page 5 of the bill, about 0.5% in 4 years and 1.5% in about 4 years later, and then 4% and 10%. Obviously, once it hits the point where it becomes least cost, it's going to take off.
Right.
Question is, how far down will it go? I mean, you do expect it to be the least cost, you say, about a decade from now?
Yeah. You know, the thing about again, this point that there's two kinds of costs. There's the panels themselves and then the cost of getting them on the building. The cost of getting them on the building is about half the cost now. And the cost of solar energy in Minnesota today is about twice the cost. If you're going to put solar panels up in New Ulm, Minnesota, it would cost you twice as much as putting solar panels up in Ulm, Germany. Because Ulm, Germany has cleared out all the red tape, all the bureaucracy, all the paperwork, all the government interference, all the utility hassle factor. But they pay the exact same cost for solar panels. They pay the exact same cost for solar panels, but they have way more. They have way less hassle factor, and they have way more efficient, competitive installer companies because they have a lot of experience. If we had a dozen companies in the Twin Cities that were doing $50 million worth of solar energy every year, that would be a pretty damn competitive industry, and prices would be falling. And that's what the intent of the bill is, to have prices come down.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry, I've forgotten your last name.
Michael Noble, N-O-B-L-E.
Mr. Noble. So the hassle factor. What can we do to make it easier to get the panels up?
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, we would like to work with you on that. We would like to work with you as a potential co-author of a bill to reduce the hassle factor yet this session.
If it's about getting government out of the way so business can do what it does, I will be happy to help you.
Okay, thank you, Senator.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Noble. Ben Gerber, and then Rick Evans. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Gerber. I'm the Energy Policy Manager for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. The Minnesota Chamber of Commerce represents approximately 2,800 businesses across the state of Minnesota. 80% of our businesses are small businesses, many of them in rural communities. I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill. I want to start off by saying the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce is not anti-renewable and is not anti-solar. We actually led an effort at the Public Utilities Commission with some of our members to work with Xcel to make sure that solar installation is treated fairly on the grid. We had some issues with the way they were currently doing it. We were able to work with them, and we're still in the process of working out a satisfactory agreement with them. And so I think what's frustrating to hear is you hear people from the production and the installation industry saying that that there's all these roadblocks, and I agree with Senator Benson. I talked to somebody that testified in support of this bill. We'd be happy to help work out the bureaucratic obstacles to solar, but I don't see any fixes in this bill to do that. And so I'd like to, like I said, I'm more than happy to help do that. But I think what we have here is a 1.33% tax on what will end up being the ratepayers' bill. And I recognize that in some of the handout that was given, that it may be only $1 or $2 on the average homeowner. But homeowners aren't the only ratepayers. There's also businesses, there's industrial customers, and they have significant energy bills. A 1.33% increase in some of the bills could be tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars a month, and those are real jobs. So while we can say that this may create 2,000 jobs according to the NREL JEDI study, there's also going to be a lot of job losses from increases in people's energy bills, and I think that's important that we can to consider. One of the things, we provided a handout that talks about electric rate trends in Minnesota. And while Minnesota has electric rates that are currently below the national average, our Minnesota rates are rising faster than in much of the Midwest. And that's an important consideration because we're home to some extremely energy-intensive industries. We have the paper mills, we have mining, and we have other large and small manufacturers that are huge employers in our state. And while the Midwest is among the lowest, has some of the lowest electricity prices in the nation, we've fallen in competitiveness. If you look at our 1990 rankings in the competitiveness in our rates, and you look at 2011, our commercial rates were 12th in the nation. We are now 18th. Our industrial rates were 15th, and they're now 25th. Our overall rates have fallen from 9th in competitiveness in 1990 to 19th overall, and that includes residential rates. So it's important to consider that our residents are also paying a significant amount more money on their energy bills. You know, I think it's important, and it was made a point was made by some of the utilities in the House hearing that, you know, if you want to create jobs, this is an extremely expensive way to create jobs. If you want to reduce carbon emissions, there are a lot better ways to reduce carbon emissions. So if we want to have that conversation, I think it's important to do that. But right now, there's nothing, there's nothing in current law. And I know a gentleman mentioned IKEA. IKEA is an example of a business that felt that as part of their public relations, they want to appear to be more environmental friendly. So they paid to install solar panels on their roof, and it was bigger than the system, I believe, is 1 megawatt, and so they had to negotiate their own rates with Xcel, and they did that. There was nothing in the current statute that prevents that. I'd also like to mention, I spoke on this briefly, there are utilities in our state, Minnesota Power and Xcel, that have voluntary programs to pay for renewable energy, and the last time I checked, when I asked the utilities how those programs were going, they're not overprescribed and they're not growing. So this idea that you can ask people, are they willing to pay more on their energy bill? That's great. But when they're going to time to put their money where their mouth is, they don't actually do that. So I think, you know, when you actually ask, hey, will you pay more, and you send them the bill, they don't actually do it. So I hesitate based on that. And another thing that I'd like to mention, and I think, to our state's credit, we've done a lot better job than California managing our grid. It was published in the Wall Street Journal that the California Public Utilities Commission and their investor-owned utilities had a meeting to discuss the potential for rolling blackouts beginning as early as 2015 due to the over-reliance on renewables, as well as some of the large retirements that they're going through. Like I said, I think we've done a better job than California, but you have to consider those issues by putting a 10% solar mandate, as well as there is a bill to also raise the renewable energy standard. So putting all these together, we have to consider that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gerber. Senator Husband.
Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Gerber, you brought up an interesting point about that the rates have changed that Minnesota ratepayers are paying since 2002. I looked at it a little bit. It seems like in about 2007, you know, we were riding along, and in 2007 there actually seems to be an increasing spike. Do you have any theories of your own on why in 2007 we would actually start seeing a more steep climb in those costs?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick. You know, I think it's still too early. We are actually looking into that. I know that the utilities came to the legislature last year with their own studies, and some of the municipals and some of the utility some of the municipal utilities said there was a large increase in cost due to the RES. Some of them said it was neutral. And I think there was a point made by one of the gentlemen earlier, Mr. Noble, that you know the RES was a least cost alternative, and I think that's important. We should be looking at least cost alternative or the least cost energy supplies and on the grid. We already banned new coal. We already banned nuclear. So, you know, to then say that okay, you have to consider 10% solar. It goes against what we have the integrated resource planning process, which utilities look and going forward what resources they need to meet the lowest cost, and I think that's important.
Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Gerber, just to let you know, there is a bill in the legislature to lift the nuclear moratorium ban because I think we do need to look at all of those base rate issues. So there is additional functions that we can take as a state to work towards having a broad spectrum. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to state for the record there is no new ban on new coal. New coal is welcome if the carbon that it creates is offset.
Thank you. Mr. Evans, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Over the last 18 months we have participated with the Department of Commerce in a series of stakeholder meetings that deal with this issue of how to advance the production of solar generation in the state of Minnesota. We think those have been really worthwhile. It was already mentioned, I should say, that we are also a member of MNSEA and an active member. I think we missed the meeting when they voted on this bill, but other than that, we've been very, very active in participation. We are also, I'm required to say by my bosses, the number one wind generating utility in the country, and I believe we're now the number eight solar generating utility in the country, primarily through our work in Colorado. But through the 18-month stakeholder period, there were some good ideas that came out of that, and some of them are incorporated in this bill, and we appreciate that. The buy-all, sell-all model that Mr. Farrell described is, we think, the way to go in the future. In this bill, they make that an option with net metering. We think that's a mistake. We think the buy-all, sell-all should be the model that we follow. And the net metering model, which has some problems, which I won't take the time to discuss today, is something that should be put in the past. So we support the introduction of the buy-all, sell-all concept in this bill and look forward to working to make that even better. We also support the value of solar concept that's in this bill, and that also came out of those stakeholder meetings. When you're doing a buy-all, sell-all, that means that the utility is still going to sell our customers all of the energy that they use, and we're going to buy the energy off of their solar panel. And the question is, well, what are you going to buy it for? In the case of wind, where we negotiate contracts for wind, you know, we enter into negotiations and interpower purchase agreements. It's not really practical for us to do that with each and every homeowner who might install rooftop solar. So you need to establish a price, and the value of solar is a recognized concept that can do that. We think that this bill includes some items in the value of solar that don't belong in there. We think that at best they are societal values and should be included in the subsidy, not in the value of solar, but that's again something we can work with the stakeholders and work out. We think a legitimate, honest value of solar is a good basis upon which to go forward with this solar energy. Finally, what this bill does that we appreciate is it recognizes that as of today, no one, or at least very, very few people, IKEA perhaps being one exception, would put solar up just for the value of solar. It's not enough money. It doesn't pay off fast enough to pay off the installation of your solar panel. So you have to have a subsidy. If you want solar, you have to have a subsidy. Currently, Xcel Energy has a program called Solar Rewards, which provides an upfront subsidy. That is, we pay upfront to buy down the cost of installing the solar panel. This bill recognizes that that's not the way to go, and we agree that it should be a production-based incentive going forward so that the customer is paid as they actually produce energy and not just for the installation of the device. Where we start to part ways with the bill is in the sheer size of what they're proposing here. Let me put it in a couple of different contexts. 10%, even in 17 years, is an enormous amount of solar. I'm not even entirely sure it's physically possible to put that much solar up. Roughly speaking, if we covered the entire city of Minneapolis with solar panels, we might get close to 10% of our solar energy, of our retail energy. Solar energy takes a lot of space. We have a project we don't own, but there's a project in Slayton, Minnesota that delivers 2 megawatts of capacity. To put that in context, the largest wind turbines these days produce 2.3 megawatts of capacity. The 2 megawatts of capacity down near Slayton covers 8 football fields. This is a resource that is different from wind. We also think that while the bill says, and this may just be a drafting error or maybe just my misunderstanding of the bill, while the bill says there's a 10% mandate, the bill also says that we have to take every customer who comes along and is willing to put the solar panels up at the price that's going to be provided in this bill. That could be 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%. We need to put some control here, both on the size and the speed with which this happens. And I think while the bill ramps up the mandate very slowly, it seems to mand up the ramp up the requirement that we buy it at a pace that is not under our control, that will be under the control of whoever happens to be out there selling solar panels. When you think of this 1.33% of the retail energy bill, it happens on residential customers to be a very small amount. But keep in mind what we're doing here. We are dedicating about $80 million a year to solar. And I think if we collect at the 1.33%, and I think it's important to think about why we would be doing that. If the point is to reduce carbon, there's a lot of ways to reduce carbon. We think that the cost of solar, what we will actually have to pay, both including our value of solar and the subsidy that would come out of the $80 million, could be anywhere from about 12 cents a kilowatt hour with the kind of things that Mr. Franzen builds to 20, 30, 40 cents a kilowatt hour for the rooftop solar. That's a very expensive way to reduce carbon. As I mentioned in my earlier testimony, we can eliminate carbon with wind at 4 cents a kilowatt hour. We can eliminate carbon through conservation at about a penny a kilowatt hour, penny and a half a kilowatt hour. And those things also create jobs. Conservation programs create a lot of jobs. Wind programs create a lot of jobs. Now, none of this is a reason not to go forward with a solar program. It is important to put our toe in the water. It's important to try this out. It may be the energy of the future. It may be that it will become very cheap as we move forward. So this is not a reason to stop and do nothing, but it's a reason to move forward cautiously. In my earlier testimony, I talked about the experiment with biomass. Biomass had a lot of promise 20 years ago, and everybody thought it was going to be cheap. And here we are 20 years later, and it's not cheap. We hope and expect that solar is going to come down in price, but that's not a guarantee. Secretary Chu is a very smart guy, but he doesn't know what's going to happen 10 years from now. He'd be a lot richer if he did. And we need to be cautious as we move forward. We need to be moderate. We need to make sure that we do not pile costs on our customers that are not warranted. I think this bill is a good vehicle for starting that discussion. We look forward to participating in that discussion as the bill moves.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, and I don't know if you have seen any numbers on this. Starting out, let me put it this way. As a senator, I have a feeling this year that I'm being asked to support and vote for a lot of things that nobody can really tell me what the costs are. And I feel there's a lot of that in this bill as well. And as we look at a definition of value of solar, we've seen some of the things that are to be considered through this legislation and developing that value. But we're going to ask our utility companies at every level to purchase power that's generated. And exactly what is a valid estimate of what this value of solar is?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think it's important to keep in mind in the structure of this bill, the energy is going to be purchased in essence out of two pots of money. Two different pots of money. The first pot of money is the value of solar. We are able to calculate that. There are benefits to solar. It does follow peak. That is, it produces the most when we need it the most. That's a value. It does, if it's on someone's rooftop or the top of their business, it does eliminate line losses and eliminate transmission needs. So, and those are things that we can calculate. When we do resource plans 15 years in the future and go through our modeling, we can calculate what the value of it is. I can't tell you what we think it's going to be. I guess I could probably say, don't if you don't make me swear to it, that it's, you know, somewhere between 5 and 7 cents a kilowatt hour. We think that will be the value of solar. But as I said, no one is going to put it up for 5 cents a kilowatt hour. And that's why the bill collects the 1.3%. I don't know that that's the right way to do it. It needs money from somewhere. I'll leave it to the policymaker to decide where that money should come from. But no one's going to put it up for, let's say it's 6 cents is the value of solar. No one's going to put it up for that. You're going to need more on that. Now, in this bill, they leave those that more blank because I don't think we know necessarily. But I think from my understanding of the industry and talking to the folks who are in the industry, it's going to be somewhere between, you know, 10 to 15 to 20, maybe 30 or more cents per kilowatt hour more to get the customers to put it up. And that's why we need to be careful. The one thing we like about this bill is that that subsidy is very easily identified. We're going to see what that is. And that's important because if the prices start to come down over time, the subsidy will be very easily identified, and we can adjust the subsidy down if that's the way we go. But right now, the subsidy is going to be significant. And it's important to keep in mind where that money is going to come from. The value of solar, we're going to collect from our customers and pay to the person who owns the solar panel. The subsidy, we're going to collect from our customers, we're going to pay it to the Department of Commerce, and they're going to pay it to the guy who owns the solar panel. And so those two, you've got to keep both of those flows of money in mind as you think about this. And it's really how much is that total going to be that is the price, essentially, that our customers are paying for that energy? Because remember, in both of my examples, it started with the customers. The money starts with the customers. And so there's going to be a subsidy. You can't have solar without a subsidy right now. And how much that's going to be, I think, is something that we need to continue to work on.
Senator Weber.
Mr. Chair, how much electricity do we use in the state of Minnesota? Anyone have that number?
I'm looking at all my utility colleagues, and they, like, I don't know off the top of our head. Many, 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 many gigawatt hours.
Yeah, so we're talking about millions of megawatt hours or gigabyte hours or whatever, gigawatt hours. And if we're talking, and it's my understanding that right now our average cost of electric production, or actually retail, is probably somewhat slightly in excess of 8 cents a kilowatt hour. Is that correct?
Our rates are a little higher than that, about 10 cents a kilowatt hour.
But if we average everybody in the state as far as privates and cooperatives and that type of thing, would that be a fairer, do you know?
Well, I think we're the cheapest, but I don't know. I don't know.
But anyway, if we get to a situation where all of a sudden you're being forced to buy power that's or charging to you, you know, at 15, 16, or 20, it's a substantial increase over what the current cost is. And if we're talking about a 10% factor here in the millions of megawatt hours that we sell in the state of Minnesota, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that are going to have to be absorbed by the ratepayers of Minnesota. Is that a safe statement?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's our concern with 10%, and that's our concern with having us take everything right now, regardless of price. But, you know, yes, if we had to buy 10% of our energy at 25 cents a kilowatt hour, and I'm not suggesting that's where this bill leads us, I'm just saying if we had to, yes, that would be a significant price increase for our customers. And that's why I'm just, you know, asking the committee to consider a modest and cautious approach to this new technology.
Thank you.
One more at this point.
And then Senator Rose, and then I want to get the other two witnesses.
Okay. Just one more thing at this point. Nationwide, what are the standards or goals of other states that are out there in the solar field?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not aware of what they are. I know 10% would be the highest in the country, surely.
Senator Rosen and then the other witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for coming in and missing a lot of the testimony, but this question is to Mr. Evans. Number one, thank you. You have, I believe, XL has been very good to solar, and obviously through the programs that you already have in place, which is the that you have a 30% renewable, where all the other utilities have 25%. You have the RDF fund, which can go to a competitive solar research project, renewable energy project. You have the solar rewards program. Is Mr. Evans, is the solar rewards program in any of the other states that you serve?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we have a program in Denver. I'm not sure. We might call it Solar Rewards. I'm not sure. It's a different program. I can get you more detail on that program, but Denver's got a different regulatory scheme than Minnesota does, and so we approach it differently. We do have significantly more solar in our Colorado service territory than we do in Minnesota. It's also in Minnesota, our really strong renewable resource is wind, and that's when what our concentration has been on. In Denver, I won't say they don't have wind, but they've got a strong solar resource there, and so different parts of the country. In Texas, for example, we have a good wind resource in Texas. We do a lot of wind in Texas. So I can certainly get you that information about what we do in other states, but it's not really comparable because there's just so many differences between the way states approach energy policy.
Right. Mr. Chair. Well, and of course, Colorado has a lot more sun days, and so they are going to direct their attention to that. But I think Minnesota has done a very good job with development of solar energy. Minnesota Power has a rebate program. The Rochester, Owatonna, Austin Public Utilities has one. Moorhead has one. New Ulm Public Utilities, Brainerd Public Utilities. We have a net metering law. The seabed tariff, that can be all applied to solar initiative. But and I know you want to get to your testifiers, Mr. Chair, so I'm just going to ask this question of a previous testifier that was up here, Mr. Gerber, that at some point, if he could find out if they take surveys with their small business owners about how important energy is, I think that would be really interesting to see where that is on their priority scale. Rosen's has a small business. Well, it's a large business, and it is manufacturing, and that is a very, very big concern for any business owner is their cost of energy and the uncertainty of the energy climate in this state. So at some point, I'd like to – I hope Mr. Gruber is still in the room. Otherwise, I'll catch him afterwards. But thank you.
We'll catch it later. Okay, thank you. Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Johnson. I represent the 44 distribution cooperatives located around the state and the 6 generation and transmission cooperatives that supply them with power. We appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill because, frankly, our members have a number of grave concerns over what's contained in the bill. We think there's it contains a number of bad policy proposals. It's the way that it raises money for incentives is incredibly regressive. And it ultimately, we believe that it's going to cost more jobs than it creates, particularly in rural Minnesota. I won't go in, step by step through the bill, but we've got 5 key objections that we have with the bill. The first is the 10% renewable energy standard. We believe that it not only reneges on the negotiated principle from the 2007 renewable energy standard, which said that utilities would be able to pursue the best, most effective renewable energy standards to meet that standard. We think it does it in an extremely expensive and inefficient way. We asked some of our generation people to do some back-of-the-envelope calculations on what the total cost of this is going to be. And just for paying for the solar panels and the installation, we estimate it's going to cost somewhere between $20 billion and $26 billion. If any of you are interested in the way that we calculated that, we did supply those with the committee, and I think they've been handed out to you. Senator Weber, just for your information, that does contain the amount of electricity that's sold in the state. It's about 72 million megawatt hours this past year, and it's estimated in 2030 that there will be we'll sell about 85 million megawatt hours. the and just even, you know, that's the at the 10% standard, meeting the 10% standard. Great River Energy, which is the largest cooperative in the state, they estimate that meeting the 1% requirement alone will cost its members $425 million in new capital outlays. And they calculated that that it will require the installation of 85 megawatts of solar generation at an installation price of what they estimated at $5,000 a kilowatt. And that's based on the National Renewable Energy Laboratory's estimates. We also think that the 1.33% $80 million sales tax is probably the most regressive way that you could use to raise money for incentives. We just don't think it's right to be asking our low, middle, and fixed income members to subsidize the installation of solar panels on multi-million dollar homes on Lake Minnetonka, Lake Calhoun, or even Gull Lake. We also are concerned that there is no member or consumer protection in the bill, only producer protection. It shifts all of the risks onto ratepayers and sends all of the benefits to the individuals who can afford to the upfront cost to install solar. Another concern that we have, it doesn't address the serious cost-shifting issues that are currently in place under the state's net metering laws. We've had the opportunity to talk to most of you, and this affects co-ops much more so than it does other utilities. We cover 85% of the geographic area in the state, and we have far, far fewer customers per mile of line to pay for that infrastructure. And this bill will still allow net metering customers to net out their energy use to avoid paying for any of the infrastructure costs that they need to have electricity delivered to them when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing, or to deliver their excess energy to the grid. And finally, we object because we don't need generation. The biggest problem that electric co-ops are facing right now is excess generation. We have enough for far into the future. In fact, Minn Kota Electric, which supplies power to munis and co-ops in the northwest part of the state, doesn't expect to build any new generation until after 2030. Right now, electric co-ops in Minnesota are losing $70 million a year on meeting the renewable energy standard because we have so much excess wind on our system. And we don't need any more of those losses. I do want to make one point of clarification, too. We've heard a lot about how solar matches the peak of a utility. That's not true in every case. For example, Minn Kota is a winter peaking system, and their daily peaks occur in the evening after the sun is set. And even in the summer peaking systems in the southern part of the state, co-ops, their peaks typically occur after dinner when solar production starts decreasing significantly. So again, you can't, one of the things that we want to avoid in any sweeping renewable energy legislation that's passed this year is to take into consideration the differences between the utilities. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Senator Benson.
Cover a lot of rural territories, small businesses, dairy farmers use a lot of electricity. What's the margin on a dairy farm? Yeah. Any idea? Can they just absorb a 1.3% increase in their electricity?
You know, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I know that most dairy farms are struggling in the state. I couldn't really tell you what their margins are. I'm sure there's probably someone in the audience who knows dairy farms better than I do. So,
and I have a question for someone. Are solar panels exempt from sales tax?
We'll check into it. I don't know.
What was the question?
If solar panels are exempt from sales tax.
Yes.
Yes, we're here. Okay. We're told yes, they are.
For now.
Senator Osmick, and then the next witness.
Mr. Chair, actually, to that last point, under the governor's proposal, are solar panels still not subject to sales tax? I don't know if council can answer that question under the current proposal, if that is changing under the governor's options.
I doubt that these council members would be reading the governor's tax bill, but we can check with
It's a point of curiosity now that she brought it up. Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Johnson, can you sort of briefly explain the term distributive generation and sort of explain how that relates to solar? I think a lot of people may or may not understand that term, and I certainly didn't until I got here.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the way that the grid grew up is over the years, through economies of scale, we moved towards a central station type grid where power is produced in large quantities in certain places and then transmitted to where the demand is located. There are benefits to distributing generation around the state. You need less transmission. However, you really need to balance. It's a balancing act for that of getting energy where it's cheapest to produce to where the demand is greatest.
Okay. Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Johnson, by increasing and continuing to increase from the local homeowner into the grid, which essentially is going reverse of the flow, does that cause cause infrastructure changes that the existing grid is going to need to compensate for?
Mr. Chair, Senator, technical issues need to be taken into consideration. The grid is not a simple plug-and-play type. It's very, very complicated, and it's very – the engineering is actually rather amazing. I think one of the other things that we also need to consider beyond just the technical aspects of it is right now, you know, we tend to view our electric bills as just buying electricity, but you're actually buying a lot more than just the electricity. You're buying its safe delivery, you're buying accessibility, you're buying affordability, and we really need to make sure that as we move towards more distributed generation and more generation that's provided by individuals, we've got to make sure that the safety, the engineering, the technical integration, we need to make sure that those are still being taken care of and are being paid for.
Thank you. We have one more witness, and we're running low on time. Mr. Black, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bill Black. I'm with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. There are 125 municipal electric utilities in the state of Minnesota and six municipal power agencies serving them with wholesale power and other services. I'll run quickly through some written testimony and see if I've covered everything that you're interested in. Municipal utilities are the original community-based energy providers. As they have worked to integrate renewable technologies, the state has allowed them the flexibility to select those technologies based on their cost and operational capabilities and generally what works best in their communities. The concepts in the proposal before you today were developed not in Minnesota, but by the Municipal Utility of Austin, Texas. The Austin utility sells more energy and has more customers than all of Minnesota's municipal electric utilities combined. Austin developed its formula customized to Austin voluntarily because they thought it was the right thing to do and not because they were told to do so by the state of Texas. And there are many reasons why what works for a large utility in Austin, Texas may not be the best solution for every utility in Minnesota. For one thing, the size of systems on customers' lands and the size of the systems that they are attached to are major concerns for our smaller municipal utilities. Under this proposal, the details of the formula that will determine the value of solar for the individual utilities are left to be determined later and then adopted by the PUC. Those details are necessary for us to understand what the formula factors really even mean. So the proposal as it stands is impossible for us to fully evaluate and therefore take a strong position on one way or the other. So at this time, we're testifying in opposition to it. Those details are crucial to the outcome of the value consideration. We have significant concerns that under the proposed informal process for coming up with the formula, the true costs and benefits of solar will be combined with factors that don't really belong in the calculation. And we have serious doubts about the ability of municipal utilities to affect the outcome of that process to prevent that. We are intrigued by the idea of the buy-all, sell-all, and value of solar model. We just want to make sure that if it goes forward, the valuation model is not thwarted by special interests or that it results in an overly simplistic formula that doesn't reflect what the true costs and benefits of solar are, particularly in each individual community where the value of the solar is being determined. So finding the true value of solar for each utility should be done objectively, and both generators and customers, we believe, should be treated fairly. Now, as far as the Renewable Energy Percentive Payment Incentive Fund, we believe that after a fair process to determine the proper formula for the true value of solar, if that value is not sufficient to incentivize the degree of solar penetration that the state deems necessary, then we think a discussion about the proper amount of a subsidy should follow, separate from the legislation creating the value of solar. In a separate proposal, we could then discuss important matters relevant to subsidizing certain Minnesotans, such as the fact that 114 of our 125 municipal utility communities have a lower household median income than the state median. We already have a very aggressive renewable energy standard, and it isn't fully implemented yet. We're halfway to our 2025 goal of 25%, and we may have done the easier half already. The flexibility was built into the agreement with utilities and Minnesota's energy customers that led to the adoption of the RES mandate in 2007. The existing solar RES, or the existing 20 by 25 RES, allows the industry to propel expansion of the state's renewable industry to agree that can be incorporated and in a flexible way that allows for consideration of cost effectiveness. The solar RES is totally inflexible and admittedly not cost effective. With a flexible RES in place, picking a specific technology like solar means forcing the utilities to invest in an energy source that is almost certainly not the least cost renewable resource. And you've seen this. I brought it along with me. And folks may disagree, but I think that it is illustrative in a general but relevant sense how we compare Minnesota to places like Texas and Florida, which has been compared to Minnesota as having a comparable solar resource. I see this map, and I see us looking a lot more like Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, New England. And that's something relevant to discuss if we're going to talk about an RES of 10% for solar, especially since at 4.5%, Arizona has the highest solar RES in the United States. You look at that map, and to us, we think few Minnesotans would think it's a good idea to have a higher solar renewable energy standard than Arizona. And finally, there are some studies proposed in the legislation, and usually those are pretty harmless and easy to pass. But it would be very impractical for all the utilities in Minnesota to go and suggest, as the bill prescribes, to suggest all the places on their systems where they could interconnect solar facilities. That would just get to be very, very difficult for especially some of the smaller utilities throughout the state. And that's all of my testimony. Mr. Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Senator Scalzi?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Mr. Black, do any of your 125 members use supply power by existing hydro?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, in fact, many of them receive federal hydropower from the Missouri River Dam system, the federal system. Some of them up to 97% of their power is federal hydropower. That doesn't count as renewable energy under the renewable energy standard. But there are also utilities that have smaller hydro facilities that do count toward the renewable energy standard. Rochester is one of them, Lanesboro, Granite Falls, and the Missouri River Energy System Municipal Power Agency is pursuing hydro in Wisconsin that will actually provide small hydropower to many of the Minnesota municipal utilities.
Senator Scalzi.
And thank you for that. And I've been visiting with lots of power companies, and I was aware, as far as I know, that Missouri River Energy supplies 43% of their power from existing hydro and from wind, which are renewable. I don't know if they fall under the renewable energy standard or not, but I don't know if that hydro does. Do you know?
No, they do not, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, what I would just suggest is that if this bill moves forward, there should be some recognition given to those energy companies that are using existing hydro and a great deal of wind energy that are probably renewable and maybe less cost. And there's energy companies that could testify. We're running out of time, but I just think it's something that should be encompassed in with this rather than just the solar, because the solar may be tough for some of those who are creating so much energy. If some of them are in the 90-some percentage and some are in the 40 percentage, it may be tough for them to meet a 10% solar standard.
And we'll be talking about all the energy stuff yet to come. So, further question, Senator Rosen, and I know I saw several hands on this side, but I'm not sure who, so we'll have to raise it. Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, and again, I apologize. Did anybody go through and explain what a 10% mandate on solar would be, how many panels that would encompass, how large of an area, if we could get did we talk about that, Mr. Chair? Yeah.
I know one of the, I think Mr. Johnson showed a chart what he, for 10%, he had a little graph printed out that talks about area and so on.
Is it this
type? The tiny type, yes.
It is. Okay. Ms. Chair, I'm just going to have to look at this a little bit more, because the 10% mandate, that's going to take a lot of land, a lot of land.
Senator Benson.
Chair, to assist Senator Rosen, if you start from the bottom and read up the numbers, the bold is 16.87 square miles.
Is for a 10% mandate?
Can you repeat that again? What was that number?
16.87.
Just said 17 square miles.
Square miles.
Further questions or discussion? Because we are about out of time. Senator Eaton, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank the committee and all of the testifiers, too. I know it's a lot of information. I would just like one of my testifiers to do a quick summary before we adjourn, if that's okay.
Very briefly, yes. And I think one of the comments I heard earlier from Mr. Jacobson, solar installers, was, yeah, we're going to have – this is going to be a difficult thing to piece everything together, and he said we have to make it work for – unis and co-ops and investor owns, because everybody's different and so on. But go ahead very briefly with your
Again, for the record, my name is Lynn Hinkle, policy director for MNCEA. We appreciate the opportunity to discuss the provisions of this bill. In point of fact, we've been discussing this bill and many of its provisions with stakeholders as part of the process that Mr. Evans spoke of before, and that process will continue to unfold. We look forward to that process, and we anticipate that one of the upshots of that will be a resolution of many of these questions that have been laid before the committee this afternoon, one of which is a concern about the calculations of the value of solar rate. And I would urge the committee to turn to Section 4, Subdivision 6, and take note of the fairly extensive discussion that lays out the computations or the basis for the computations for the value of solar. We don't expect the market opportunity that the value of solar rate to be wasted by generic terms that won't lead us to a place where we can capture that opportunity. And before I turn it over to Mr. Farrell, I want to point out again that the other market opportunity that we see this bill presenting is the growth of manufacturing, good family-sustaining jobs throughout the state that will have a profound impact on entities all around the table, all throughout the state. I think it's important for people to understand that this, while it is energy policy, is at a deeper level economic development, the creation of jobs, the creation of development in communities throughout the state.
Mr. Furrow, you got 1 minute because we're over time, so go ahead very quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick address on the land area. Minnesota was part of a technical analysis of every state of the rooftop potential. 24% of our electricity could come from solar installed on rooftops. We have more than enough rooftop space that we don't have to mow a single blade of grass if that's the way we wanted to go about it. I'd be happy to provide the citation for that study to the committee. Just a quick summary overview. The solar energy standard is really about a merging of ratepayer interest in expanding solar energy production and is what we think is reasonably ambitious on the basis of solar energy standards in other states. It's about a diversity of location and suppliers that will create Minnesota jobs and position Minnesota industry to supply solar energy production in other states as solar continues to expand. It uses market-based and production-based incentives that really put most of the risk onto the developer of solar, because if they don't produce energy, they do not get paid. And ultimately, its goal is to streamline the process, to lower the cost of solar, to broaden participation, and to tap into Minnesota's business expertise to supply 10% energy from solar. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, this is to be included in an omnibus bill. Will we have another opportunity?
You will have plenty of time to discuss this. And other provisions that may be included. We'll be doing some of that. We have plenty of bills in both energy and other environmental things coming up. I know the Game and Fish Subcommittee is finishing its work soon. Lands will be meeting soon. There's more than enough bills to deal with in the committee.
I'm on it.
With that, this committee is adjourned. We'll see you Tuesday.
The most